This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Unsettled Diasporas. So in case you didn't know, this panel discussion is around carving out spaces for feminisms when you are marginalized, and obviously our particular genre is Asian. So first off, Y is going to open our panel with a bit of context around our zine, Mellow Yellow.
Cool. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. I started Mellow Yellow because I was feeling, I guess, a kind of disconnect with my ethnic background, I think particularly in an ancestral sense. An awareness of that kind of disconnect came from engaging in decolonisation and learning about how to be in alliance and in support of Tinoranga Teretanga around the foreshore and seabed confiscation in 2004. And around then, there's lots of conversations around Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and a lot around biculturalism, which was a conversation seen to be between Māori and Pāhia. And I wondered where I fit in as a Chinese diasporic person whose parents grew up in Malaysia. So I wondered where I fitted in. Working with Māori and within Te Ao Māori, it became clear to me that people operating as individuals weren't as trusted or were trusted less, in a sense, because it seemed to be more about, who you are was around who your people are and who speaks for you and who you speak for, collectively. So it seemed in that world that the strength and the responsibilities and the complicities and solidarities were more of a collective thing rather than an individual thing. And so I think most people who are part of some kind of marginality kind of know this in some sense, where the whole, tarred with the same brush, speaks to that. And so some of you will be familiar when you have your parents or your grandparents say stuff like, "Ooh, if you do this, you'll bring shame on the family name, you'll bring shame on the village, and you'll bring shame upon our people." So I think that's kind of the, in some ways, the stink side of things. As in why just because if I smoke cigarettes or drink or am gay or trans or I have mental health issues or I'm unemployed, why should that reflect badly on my family or on my ethnicity? I think at the same time, the upside of this, if you can call it an upside, is that there's a slightly intangible cohesion in a lot of ways, for better or for worse, that moves us and shapes us collectively as a peoples, whatever that actually means, So I started Mellow Yellow because I wanted to find other people like me, other Asian people that wanted to unsettle our diasporic settling on our terms, in our ways, on the terms of our ancestors, rather than on, I guess, kind of like Pākehā angsty terms. And for me, this meant searching for my ancestors and their tales and journeys to understand what my obligations are, or our obligations are, based on also, I guess, being my ancestors, if that makes any sense. Kind of like what they would have wanted, given the injustices of these lands we create our homes on, and the benefits and complicities that we participate in regarding the theft and colonisation of Māori land. And I suppose I see it as work that we have to do rather than work that I have to do. So I believe these obligations are handed down to us ancestrally. So in the first edition of Mellow Yellow, there are tales about various people's ancestors, some Pākehā who were the original group of young Tāwiwi, young people, when we were doing like Te Tiriti education and decol learnings and actions and anti-racism work. And the other aspect of identity as us and we rather than just me is, I guess, I don't know, what we could call broadly Asian feminism, if that is at all even a useful grouping. I guess for me that's about exploring and confronting the power-laden structures of other kind of older inherited obligations and tensions. And Asian, as we know, is a kind of very broad coverall term that doesn't speak particularly well or meaningfully to colonisation and state and empire within the greater Asian region. particularly, I guess, with me in regards to China being a very long-standing empire and nation that it is, and the violence that happens in, internally as well as externally that comes with empire and nation states. So, yeah, I guess it's how do we navigate that as diasporic peoples living in settler states? And also, what are some of the methods, what are some of our methods and resistances and processes when we address inequities and oppressions within our own cultures, families and lineages? So for me, Mellow Yellow and my participation in, I guess, like Asian activist stuff is about, I guess structural collective stuff, if that's a, you know, and about kind of diaspora, about being a settler, being a migrant, about how that all fits in with, you know, global nation statehood. And then also about creating space to address the ills of racism and internalized racism, and how culture and family affects us regarding sexualities and gender, you know, how, what state social and familial violence looks like, how language loss affects us, and what are some of the social pressures around, like, jobs and kids and having partners that can also be quite culturally particular at times. So, yeah, I guess I'm having this loose grouping over the last, I don't know, like, 8 years, 7 years? I'm not really sure. After the last wee while has, helped me to have lots of clarity and sustenance, which has enabled, I think, networks to grow and for me to be a bit clearer slightly around how I cultivate my practice of social justice in Aotearoa. Yeah. So, yeah.
When did you start?
I don't actually know. Yeah. I think it was after Foreshore and Seabed, which means it was after 2004.
Yeah.
So.
Thank you for that really far-reaching context. It's awesome to hear. So the format for this is quite loose, and I think we're just going to kind of ask each other questions and get some responses from the group. Was that your sort of vision, Mingzu?
Kind of envision it to be a kind of conversation
between
us about some of the things that we want to talk about and share with you all. I guess I can talk a little bit about my connection to Mellow Yellow and some of the things that from the first issue. It was actually really eye-opening for me when I think I was given the zine by someone, and at the time I did not know any other Asian people involved in grassroots social justice or feminist activism, and I was really trying to understand some of the issues around being Chinese on colonized land as well, and with the conversations being majority bicultural, it was really I guess validating to see someone else talking about it from a similar background. And so I got in touch with Y, and we worked on the second issue, I think, in 2007. I'm better at remembering dates. And from there, we decided that maybe there are probably more people like us that we can connect with and get them on board to contribute. So from there, it kind of grew. Now we have about 6 issues. They come out pretty irregularly, like whenever we get around to doing it. And sometimes we all kind of travel around the world as well. And actually some of our contributors aren't from here, been all over the world. So there's various perspectives in the scene.
So I tried to avoid talking, actually, but here I am. So I was going to talk about this thing of others in a kind of New Zealand colonised context. So I guess... Being a recently colonised country, it's pretty common, more increasingly so, to have people like me, mixed people, you know, popping up everywhere, and people asking you where you're from. And I guess the thing that I thought about in relation to this panel was the feeling of not so strongly identifying as Pākehā or not so strongly identifying as Chinese, but that category of other being a really kind of defining identity for me, more so than... kind of any other blood identity or whatever you want to call that. I'm doing scare quotes for people who are listening to this. and I guess me kind of feeling more that I aligned with other others than other Chinese or other Pākehā, and I'm going to single out Sally, and I'm going to single out Heather, wherever she is, and people like that who I feel also understand that difficulty of not always being so welcomed by one parent group, and having to kind of carve out another space with other people who experience that kind of detachment or what's another way of describing it? Does anyone else want to try? Sorry?
Alienation.
Yeah, kind of alienation, and I guess especially because, like, I suppose in like a New Zealand context, we're very familiar, or there's an understanding that for Māori, you have the ability to whakapapa, and that's kind of enough of a claim. And in a way, you can kind of say it, and that's true. Mm-hmm. But I feel like for Chineseness, at least how the way I feel like I'm presented, you have to really pass.
Mm-hmm.
And because I don't pass, and it seems to be a kind of pure blood thing, I'm doing scare quotes again, it's very hard to feel a part of that group. And instead, the other group is kind of the one that I belong to mostly, and I feel like that comes into play in all the forms. You know, when I give blood, it kind of says ethnicity, other, you know, all sorts of things like that. So those weren't very coherent thoughts, but that was kind of what I wanted to talk about. Does anybody else want to contribute to that, or anyone in the audience that felt like they had something they wanted to expand on?
I'm really glad you said that, because I can relate to it.
Oh yes.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. As a double diaspora kid, kind of like you, I suppose, like, I'm Indian, but I'm Malaysian Indian, and so that connection to India is very distant and remote, and I had never set foot into India until 2009? I don't know, sometime. It was the first and only time. And, the identification with just being other is something that really, really resonates with me, I think. As a migrant, I feel that's the common experience amongst all migrants, you know, and that's how we get to know each other.
Yeah, and it feels like it's a very different "where are you from" question that I get. Mm. It's like a "where are you from," and, you know, obviously New Zealand's never says factory answer.
No.
And then if you kind of tell people why you look different, they kind of tell you, "Oh no, but you'd..." "No, it's not Chinese." I've had that thought. "No, it's not Chinese. Maybe Filipino?" And you're like, "No, I've just told you the answer. But thank you for your professional opinion." You know, it's like a weird kind of place to be in.
Someone tried to hit on me the other day by asking me where I was from, and I replied, "Tiadu South." And that really confused them, but also not enough to like stop them continuing with the play that they already had. So they're like, "Oh yeah, that sounds really exotic." I'm like, "That's Scotland, buddy."
I think it's interesting what you have touched on in relation to like not feeling with one group or the other. I think in a way that is kind of culturally relevant to those of us that are like 1.5 generation. Mm. I think we feel that with like culturally.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when I go back to China, I don't fit in as Chinese, but when I'm here, I don't fit in as, you know, the dominant culture either.
Yeah.
So it's kind of that in-betweenness.
Yeah.
That Kirsty, maybe you might be able to relate to as well.
I was thinking about the multiplicities of like privilege and marginalities. In saying so, I am Han Chinese on my mother's side, which means that we're colonists, you know, like Chinese imperialists in Singapore, where I was born. And on my father's side, they were indentured labourers from the poll tax era, gold mining, and so there was a lot of yellow peril stuff there. There was a lot of xenophobia. And now being on this land here, I have a lot of, you know, privilege in terms of, I guess, assimilation and also economically. But when you walk down the street, you encounter a lot of microaggressions, all of that stuff. So it's kind of different navigation of that sort of stuff.
I wanted to ask everyone about language and what kind of role you feel that that plays in space and
accent privilege.
Yeah, or like for me, I only speak English because my family came to New Zealand in the 80s, and so that was kind of the doctrine of the day, assimilate or die. And so being able to speak fluent, unaccented English was really important, but that meant we lost so much. And coming to terms with that has been a really important part of my journey, I think.
Yeah, I think I can really agree with the whole language and accent kind of thing, because I was born in New Zealand, but lived in Beijing and Singapore when I was younger. And even being in an international school, you know, you have this American accent. I came back when I was 12, and having to have, you know, a very Chinese-looking face, being like, who are you, where are you from, you know, and having to unpluck the American accent into something key to be more accepted was, it actually is, like, a privilege. And coming back into New Zealand at the age of 12 as well, like, there was a lot of other, like, first-generation, you know, Chinese kids that I was hanging out with, and, like, that's how you sort of, like, as a, you know, helping navigate the differences between the types of Asian.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always find that really, like, it kind of really bothered me that, you know, one person would be Lisa because they just did not have, you know, the key accent or whatever.
And then returning to those more first generation communities, the like idea of being a banana or an Oreo, you know, where because you don't have language, that means you're not properly an Asian person.
Yeah,
I felt like that was kind of my mum's experience a little bit. So being the eldest of four, and her parents not speaking English, and being the kind of translator for the family, and really appreciating how important it was to have this English language skill that you can kind of be as good as everyone else with or something. And I feel like maybe in some way that kind of influenced her career as a kind of proofreader type person, being just like better than the white people at their own language or something like that. You know, I felt like it kind of, that quickly she kind of learned that was a way that you could be respected or claim back some of the power that's been taken from you or something.
I had a recent experience with like deciding whether to speak Chinese or English. So I came to New Zealand when I was six, so I didn't have any schooling in China, but I did know the language. It was my first language. But I remember when I got here, when I was kind of growing up to intermediate school, I was kind of like trying to shy away from learning the language, and that's because, you know, like, white supremacy exists and English is the dominant kind of way of communicating. And I remember, you know, my parents making me go to Chinese classes and stuff like that, and I didn't want to go and make excuses, but now I really regret that. And my recent experience was I work for an organization called Shakti, and we do campaigns around family violence in our communities, and I was speaking to Chinese media, and I was trying really hard to be able to communicate what I wanted to say in Mandarin, but I just couldn't do it, and the reporter was just like, just speak English. And that felt kind of like, oh, I really need to learn more. And I guess, you know, I've thought a lot about going back to China or being in an environment that speaks more Mandarin to be able to maintain it, because, I mean, I think it's hard if you never learnt it to begin with, but when you have, it's easier to pick it up again. So, yeah, I guess we originally want to talk about feminism as well, right, and how that relates to our lives. And I think actually zine making is one of the ways that I got, like, it was a form of, like, consciousness raising for me. Like, I learnt about feminism through zines and making zines, because you kind of, like, can kind of talk about personal stuff and relate it to political things and try and understand the bigger picture through the process of writing and connecting with other people.
Yeah, and it's non-hierarchical as well. Mm. Like, I quite like that. It's kind of person to person, and you can say what you want. It's uncensored.
Doesn't have your polished writing.
Yeah.
I came to feminism through academia, which was really weird, because you're like one brown face and a million non. So finding a space where my feminism actually made sense to me personally and wasn't about, one, trying to save myself from my own culture, because that was very, didn't really resonate. Finding a post-colonialism, intersectional kind of feminism that actually was true to who I was and didn't come from somewhere else. And finding feminists that were Asian and had been really involved for a long time, and understanding the really rich history of Asian feminism was really important to me. And so when I finished my undergraduate degree, I went and worked in both Thailand and Malaysia in feminist NGOs, and so being in a completely Asian feminist space was interesting and very challenging, but also amazing.
Yeah, where did everyone else like feminism?
My mum. my mum, but also specifically Asian feminisms from Minzu and Shasha. Came to uni one day and they were talking about Shakti, which is a feminist domestic violence agency. It does amazing work. And at that time, I was part of another feminist organization and it wasn't doing it for me. And only in retrospect, I realized it was because they were white liberal cupcake feminists, you know? And they were casually transphobic and they were casually racist, and that really didn't do it for me. So Mingzu, actually. Mingzu and my mom.
Wow.
Yeah, I think you played a part in it for me too, probably. So I was already kind of come through academia and stuff and had some friends' mums who were pretty political, and it was all starting to stew in my head. And then what class are we in together? Was it human sexualities or woman studies or something? Yeah. And there was this like little kid who used to come to school on a push scooter, like the one that nobody even takes a push scooter anywhere. And it was Mingzu, and she'd like just scoot into class, just totally unashamed, pack up her scooter during the class and would sit there. And then she'd pop it open and scoot wherever she was next going. It was like, man, who is this kid that scoots around? And then we became friends and it was good. And then I ended up living in a super feminist flat, and it was great. It all just kind of grew, and Y was there, and Mingzu was there, and Sally and Nicola were there, and Heather was there for a bit. We all just kind of fed off each other and wound each other up, mostly Sally. But yeah, that was really formative for me. In many ways, the house is way more educational than being at university, having conversations with real people, not just kind of stuffy white lecturers and stuff.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, it's just so much more intersectional when it's real and it's people and it's you're talking about it and people's lives and stuff, you know.
Yeah. I always say that I had my best feminist education from the blogosphere. Like, that's where I really found, like, intersectionality and feminism that was not stupid. Yeah.
It's a technical term.
Yes, very. How about you, Wyatt?
I guess I don't really know. Yeah, I guess I was aware that there was feminism, and that a lot of it was around, I guess, stuff that just didn't seem really relevant to me around like work and stuff. And I knew that, you know, while there was a struggle for a white woman to be able to enter the workforce, I knew my mother was cleaning people's houses, so I'm like, well, she's really working. There was a lot of stuff that I guess didn't fit, and I could see that it was like a white feminism, so I just knew there has to be other forms. And so, yeah, I guess reading around and seeing, I guess, lots of the kind of manawahine and participation within Tino Rangatiratanga, I knew that... that women have always been integral to social justice movements, and that it wasn't always like a you didn't always have to caucus off.
Mm.
So I remember hearing, I guess, about one of the tensions of, was it Reclaim the Night or something, and there was a conversation where, I guess Māori woman was saying, well, our men should march behind us. And I was thinking, like, oh, okay, that's really interesting. So, yeah, I guess from there, reading lots of different things around, like, Indigenous feminisms and Third World feminisms, made me be like, okay, well, it's obviously connected.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that look like? You know, what does it look like when we organise? And what does it look like in our meetings? What does it look like in our houses? That kind of thing. Who ends up doing the dishes? That kind of stuff.
And I think it's really important to acknowledge how colonial white feminism actually is and the roots of it in that way. Does anyone have anything they want to say about that?
I think my first experiences with feminism was working in predominantly Pākehā women's groups, and I kind of felt like in that space there wasn't like much of an acknowledgement of other cultures, and like I felt like, you know, that kind of had to be an assimilated person of colour to be able to even like communicate on that level. So I had enough of that, and found other people, which was really, it's hard to express like that feeling of affinity when you kind of find someone else that has had like similar experiences or can share, or like, you know, it's a shared understanding of what it's like to be Asian, or, you know, socialized as women, or, you know, read as female. These experiences are things that we can kind of like leverage off to talk about other political issues, because all these forms of oppressions, like, we experience them and they're not like something out there. And so it's kind of better that, you know, you can start having self-determined spaces and movements where your experiences are reflected. So does anyone want to kind of maybe share some of those things, like experiences that they might have had in maybe Pākehā-dominated feminist spaces?
Do you want me to say something? You're looking at me. So I'm involved in a lot of more mainstream women's groups, like the secret radical person infiltrating them. And I feel like it's a weird kind of level of respectability politics where I sit there and kind of go, yes, I am so well behaved and good, yes, you know. I guess they're all old white feminists.
Mm.
And they're all very kind of second wave.
Mm.
And we always have these conversations which is like, why are there no young people? Where are the young people? Why are there no people of colour? And it's like, because you guys keep them out, you know? There's not really an awareness that so much of that identity excludes so much and doesn't make people want to join. And I guess my involvement there feels like a way to kind of slowly chip away at that, even though it's really exhausting.
It's also like the issues that they work on are really centred around white women.
Yeah. And very kind of like classist as well, you know. Mm. They're very kind of,
And the thing with like challenging white women in these spaces, it's a whole nother struggle because...
Yeah, such a power imbalance.
Yeah. And having to see nods. And then it kind of like, you know, what Kirsty was saying, like, white women's tears, it's like it becomes about them, like they're hurt by being accused of being racist. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, you know, like just re-centers their experiences.
Yeah, for sure. And it always comes back to the things that they fought for, and I feel like, yeah, cool, pat on the back, thank you, you know. What about things that are affecting people today? You know, it's always kind of like, you guys have it so easy now, you don't know shit, all of, you know. I find that really dismissive. It's really hard to kind of engage with people and work towards something better when they keep holding on to the past.
Mm.
Yeah. And it's funny as well because, you know, they felt that about the previous generation,
mm.
iteration of feminists, and yet they're unable to see that they kind of put it on,
yeah.
on us.
And I think it's important to acknowledge that you have that same dynamic in Asian feminist mm-hmm. spaces as well. This idea that you haven't paid your dues, you yeah. haven't earned your place in the movement, and I guess part of it is cultural, like this idea of respecting your elders. Mm-hmm. But yeah, those dynamics do happen, and they're really hard to kind of shift and to move. In the same conversations of about why are there no young people? Well, because you don't invite them.
You hate young people.
Yeah. You want them to come, but you don't want them to say anything.
Yeah. Sort of be there as for like a kind of box ticking sense of
yeah,
exercise.
Yeah.
Yes, we got some young people. Good.
When I was working in Malaysia, I went to a conference and they were really showcasing the fact that they had like really centered young people in this conference, but what young people were invited to do was to give the flowers to the speakers, and that was their like involvement. So that was interesting.
Yeah, I feel like some of the groups that I'm involved with, they're always trying to do various get-together things, but there's always a charge, and it's like $20, and I'm like, that's immediately leaving people out, you know. It's super exclusive to have
yeah.
a cover charge that's actually a lot of money.
Mm.
Of course you're only going to get a subset of people that can afford that, and they're like white, middle-class, retired women.
Mm.
That's who you get.
Mm.
And then they come and talk about the issues without anyone present who should be involved, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's embedded in cultural arrogance as well.
Yeah.
That attitude. Like, for instance, today is it National Poetry Day today?
Yes,
it's
today.
Just on and off, just in addition to this. But this week, for instance, there was a discussion being held at the Auckland Public Library about feminism.
Mm.
And we were having a look at that and thought, you know, like, oh, yeah, that's... I mean, you know, it's an assumption made there that, of course, Pākehā women are going to control the discussion
mm.
on what feminism is.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, and, but spaces have already been made by people of colour
mm.
and by Māori women
mm.
For our voices to be heard. And yet there's still no, you know, honest, inclusive, you know, willingness to dialogue with us.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like, so big ups to you guys for organising this today, because it's really essential to have this conversation and to be having it continuously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just want to add to this. In 1985, I went to the UN, a women's forum in Sydney and Nairobi. At both those conferences, the women, of course, who were organising those conferences were white women, you know, from around Australia, Europe, etc. And they've all got their own perspectives on, you know, how that power dynamic works, and it was fucking frightening. But what I want to say is that, you know, we all have feminisms in our own cultures, and it's really essential to keep forging that cordial, that voice to be heard in international, you know, forums such as that, and the type of week that you've been talking about, mm-hmm. to always continue that voice should be heard. It has to be maintained.
Mm-hmm.
And the racism back then in the 80s was quite, you know, it was like, I thought it was in your face, but to them it's just an ordinary kind of day-to-day kind of thing. But if we hadn't have done that, it wouldn't have... we wouldn't have been able to have ignited that sense of solidarity with other women of colour,
mm-hmm.
Aboriginal women, American Indian women, Asian women, all of our colours.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, yeah, I just want to say that. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a really interesting thing. Like, within New Zealand, there's very little, like, public dialogue, for example, between, like, Asians and Māori and Indigenous people, and how those like migrants sit kind of uncomfortably on stolen land. Mm-hmm. I think it's something that we all write and talk about a lot. But the idea that there's always whiteness facilitating that discussion we're just invited to the table, but we can't directly sort of sit down together.
With the guest speakers.
Yeah, all the little tokens. Is there anything you want to add around that, Brian?
I'm just thinking we've got 15 minutes left because we finish at 2:38. Is there anything that we want to talk to? Want to talk about?
Yeah, we have someone here with a Chinese-sounding last name.
We'd like to buy a house.
To talk about housing.
Well, I mean, we can all talk about
housing. Not me, I'm a Reynolds. I'm not buying a house.
Did you get your t-shirt? Nationalism. I also have a property investor hat.
So everyone knows that I... What your agenda is, yeah.
My gender?
What your agenda is. I don't know how specific the hair.
Got long hair. I don't actually know where to start. I guess any acknowledgement about housing issues is to be taking place on... we have to acknowledge that it's taking place on colonised and stolen land, so anything... Any change-making venture, anything, has to be in solidarity with Tangata Whenua. I stand in solidarity with the Tāmaki Housing Group. It's a group of ladies out in GI who are actively fighting the evictions and demolitions and destruction of their community, and that's happening in the name of gentrification and privatisation. They're also mostly Tangata Whenua. GI has a massive history of being home to Māori war battalions, and it's another form of neocolonialism, and it's absolutely disgusting. But being, I guess, one of the only Asian faces in the whole housing struggle is a really funny place to be in, because it's a bicultural rhetoric and. Mm-hmm. You've got the government saying no to asset sales, you know. They're taking our land. It's like, well, you've already taken the land. Like, it doesn't make any sense. But us as model minorities, we're used as pawns. Yeah. So we're useful in some discussions and scapegoated in others. And xenophobic rhetoric is really, really easy because it's deep-seated hatred, I think. It's deep-seated othering of people who are kind of jaundiced, you know. It's an open discussion, but it's I think, continual exploration into where I sit personally in this. But always, I think, fundamentally in solidarity with Tangata Whenua.
Yeah, it makes me kind of think from what you were saying about, from what you were saying, Whaitiri, as well as what you were saying, Kirsty, is how, I guess, you know, when people say, oh, when I'm asked where I'm from, when Asian people or whoever, who's in fashion that day, to be used as a scapegoat, becomes used as a scapegoat, what has happened is that, I guess, thinking about it, is colonisation has disrupted or damaged the relationship that could have been formed. So, you know, it's really different for me when someone who is Pākehā asks me where I'm from as opposed to someone who's Māori asking me where I'm from, because the kind of... what you're trying to establish is different.
Yeah.
And I think the relationship has been damaged as well, so that we... because things are mediated... not only through the English language, of which we speak and need to speak to talk to each other now, the relationships have been damaged, so we haven't been able to settle, honourably and in negotiation with Tangata Whenua, that all that is mediated again through Te Ao Pākehā. And so Yeah, you know, whether it's housing because people are concerned about their security and needing places to live, or whether it's what language and whose language should be taught in secondary schools, or, you know, conversations around feminism and who needs to be saved from whom, that kind of thing. Yeah, what are the ways in which we can continue to bypass, I guess, that white noise or that white disruption to have those conversations outside, to repair the relationships that have been damaged through colonisation that, I mean, we might have damaged those relationships ourselves anyway. You know, it's not like, yeah, we're all perfect, but yeah, how do we continue to have those connections, really?
Yeah. And I think, for me personally, I've always seen within my own family and culture the idea that assimilation is contingent on acceptance by whiteness, and that means by putting ourselves at odds with tangata whenua and participating in that colonial framework, because that's how you get ahead as a migrant.
Yeah, but that's all mediated by the state as well. Yeah, and conquered
tactics. Definitely, I totally agree. Yeah. Is there more things on the piece of paper we want to talk about? Yeah.
Neoliberalism was also being adopted by Māori as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, does anybody want to add anything or ask anything? Or we're experts. So here's your chance.
In our non-hierarchical way.
So those of you who kind of identify as culturally other and feel kind of displaced, you find yourself having to sort of inhabit the white sort of, the dominant white spaces for feminism that we kind of, you know, dominate our sort of feminist. Do you find yourself having to be the go-between between all of these groups?
Oh, well. Yeah, I guess I am in a sense. Like, I feel, yeah, especially that within all these kind of white groups I'm part of, where I don't know what they think of me. And it's hard to know. Am I just another white person there, or am I the kind of token person?
Maybe you don't
person?
Want to know.
Are you the person they're comfortable with? Like,
yeah.
White enough?
The safe,
like, the safe segue into someone a bit more Asian.
Yeah. It's like when people call you, like, say, you're not like all the other Asians, as if it's a compliment, you know? Yeah, that kind of... That's when you know people think of you as being safe. Any other questions?
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say, and I wonder how much of that is actually generated by me. You know, me feeling so familiar with white culture as well, that I kind of almost have gravitated to it in a sense, you know, that these groups, maybe while I don't actually feel fully accepted there, or I don't feel totally comfortable with them, I'm familiar enough with kind of white culture to know how to be in it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and that's a privilege in a way. Familiarity. Yeah.
Totally, it's such a privilege that you can be kind of read as white, that people, you can kind of be in a space without kind of overt racism directed at you all the time.
Yeah.
I guess I also wonder if it's strategic in a sense of there are spaces that you know that if you act a certain way, you will be granted access.
Yeah.
If you dress in a certain way, talk in a certain way, whatever,
you know
that you can get in. And that stink. And that's also strategic. So if we want access, we do these certain things. And I think there's a degree where we know what we're doing, you know, and you do it to get stuff done, or you do it to feed your family, or to get that job, or to get that house, or whatever you need to do. And so then I guess what else is also part of the strategy?
Yeah, and I guess I feel like for me part of it is, it sounds so kind of tactical, but like some kind of infiltration of those groups to kind of come and be like,
invasion?
Here I am, I'm very nice, and, you know, kind of, you know, talk about the things that they don't want to talk about, racism, transphobia, this kind of stuff.
Yes.
And then they have to have a chat about it because, but you liked me, I was so nice, you know? Let's talk about it. Put some shit on their agenda that they maybe otherwise wouldn't have come across.
It must be different working with older white women.
Yeah.
Have you have you had like an experience working with young girls?
Do you mean other than my friends? in groups and stuff.
Yeah,
in groups,
yeah.
Well, IFA and stuff like that. But yeah, no, what have I got with these old white women? Why do I keep going back to them?
Any other questions from the floor?
I am wondering, you mentioned a while back that you were sort of excited in learning about feminism. Mm-hmm. Who are those key Asian feminists who discovered the black way?
Yeah, so me in particular, I'm really influenced by South Asian feminism because it's something that really speaks to me. And especially when I moved back to Asia, which like repatriation is a whole other thing in and of itself, but anyway, like Chandra Mohanty, man, you've put me on the spot and now, wait, you know when you're trying to think of things and your brain goes blank? Yes, Gayatri Spivak. So many. And there's, like, once you kind of start digging, it opens up this whole plethora of voices that if you grow up learning feminism in, like, a white dominant space, you just don't even realise even exist, and it's quite mind-blowing. Like, for me, I'm Malayali, which comes from, like, the south of India, and that has a really rich history of women's participation in politics and activism. And, like, women in my culture became worse off through colonization, which is not a narrative that you hear very often, but is very true. So, that's why I love the internet, you know? Like,
we all love the internet.
Yeah.
Was there any acknowledgement of those feminists that you just mentioned in academia?
A little bit. I'd like to say that because I studied political studies, and the Auckland political studies faculty is very critical theory oriented, which is nice. And so there was some. It wasn't as whitewashed as some other departments, maybe, but very little. I think we read Mohanty, and probably that was about it.
It feels like for me when those kind of authors were included, it was really like a special topic of, you know, one week in your whole class kind of thing, and
exactly.
It's always facilitated by your white lecturer.
Yes.
And it's kind of contextualised as this other kind of, here's what some radical people were doing while this mainstream stuff was happening, you know?
Yeah,
it's totally. It's never really kind of brought to the front or...
Yeah, it's never centred, yeah.
There's a lot of Judith Butler in it. Like,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so much Judith Butler. Don't get me wrong, I love Judith Butler, but like, she wasn't the first or the only person to have those ideas. Yeah. Yeah.
And the bitter taste is it's all in English.
Yes.
It's all mediated through English and academia.
Yeah.
What's published and what's not.
Yeah.
I have a question. You were talking about microaggressions earlier, and I know that there's Pacific Island diaspora the community. I was just, because these are things that you kind of do, and it's funny when you have to be on the panel, and like, what are the things that are specific? And like, so if there are microaggressions along there, and you talk about strategies, and the zine is one response, for example, and this panel is another, and you do such, you know, sort of intersectional work. If you had strategies that, as you know, they're microaggressions, are there micro responses that responding to these?
That's nice.
Stop there, you say these
micro responses.
So I just wondered if, as a group, you had,
I think before we start, all of the white people have to leave the room. I'm joking.
No, I mean, because, like I said, when it happens to me, people say these things, so, like, you speak English so well, I'm just so stunned.
Oh, I...
would be you. You know, like, because it happens so much that it kind of, like, you just laugh or cry, that I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that, too.
I feel like responding Tia Chu South when people ask me where I'm from is a micro resistance.
Yes, micro resistance.
Yeah.
Because that is, the people are always asking me, where are you from? And I want to say, where are you from? You know, as this Pakeha person. And I'm like, oh, I was born here, but you weren't here. You got all sorts, you know, like, nice spots. And you're like, so, oh, so you came here, oh, like, I was born here, so your ancestors came in 18. Yeah. They ask you, like, I don't know you, what makes you think you can ask me these things?
So entitled.
I want to deal with it. Like, okay, just like.
Another micro-resistance that I have is insisting on the proper pronunciation of my name and not allowing people to call me by shortened versions anymore. Yeah, that's really important to me.
Yeah, downstairs at the zine table, did you do it, Minzy? We've written like for the prices of the zine, we've written like $1 to $5 and you pay what you want, depending on the privilege scale. It's really just to kind of pay what you want, but people are like, oh, quite confronted because they have to go, oh, I have to quantify all my privileges right now.
Just pay $5
in front of everybody. That's quite funny. Yeah.
It's like a lighthearted way.
Yeah, and then I think a couple of our zines, wait, let me get this right. Some of them read left to right and some of them read right to left, so the opposite of what other people think. And that's often quite, people really perplexed and don't know how to read it, and we're like, oh yeah, yeah. So I think, yeah, I guess little things that we do, particularly with the zine, that kind of disrupts things a little bit.
Mm.
And so, yeah.
And like, for me, surrounding yourself with people that get it, you know, like especially our whare, just being able to be, just come home and be like, ugh, you know, and that microaggression book. We made a microaggression book because so frequently we were confronted with shit that pissed us off, and then we'd kind of talk it out and become this phrase like, put it in the book. And the act of actually having to put it in the book was just too stressful that the book just remains empty. We never got to writing in the book because it was just like, oh, it was just too intense to actually have to...
Makes it too real to see it written down.
It's just enough to kind of say it out loud and know that there's the book. If it was really serious, you could put it in the book.
Yeah, actually, like, the other day, my car got towed. And then when I went to, like, pick up my car, the guy was like, where are you from? This white guy. And, like, you know, I get real tired of answering, like, the series of answers that I first answered. So I'm just like, China. And he was like, oh, I'm going there soon. Like, where would you recommend? It's like, I don't know, I haven't been everywhere in China. Like, I'm not going to give you free travel advice. After my car's just been towed. But yeah, it's like really annoying that, you know, it's like you're a representative of China and everything about it, and give me free travel advice. No.
Did anybody else want to share any kind of micro resistance techniques?
I just let a beat go, so it's like silent for a beat, and then I'll answer because usually people feel embarrassed.
You're like, I hate you.
But has a fairly nice success.
There was one time, this is not very micro, I suppose, there was one time I said, I'm going to stop talking to you now, and just talked. Nice! This one guy was really pissing off, he was just like, where are you from? And I think I said, he looked up and he was really, really from. I said, I'm going to go now.
Going back home, and I'm not telling you where it is.
Yeah. Because I found that saying Te Aritu South instead of New Zealand or Auckland or something like that is really specific and very confusing to people, so it really shuts them up. And then you don't have to follow along with the subsequent questions. But yeah,
I'm not really sure about the ethics of this, but I pretend that I can't speak English. Like, it got me out of school heaps. Or now, the other day, I searched up Chinese accents on YouTube because I wanted to get rid of my Kiwi accent. Seriously, because it gives me a lot of access. Right? And someone like turns around and like, hello, and you're like, hello. Like, they treat you differently from when you're like, hello. But again, I'm not really sure how.
That makes me uncomfortable. I don't really know.
It's really cringe. Or just identifying yourself.
Yeah.
So they don't have to do it for you. Being as facetious as possible.
Yeah, I think there was one time like someone asked us where we were from and we just stared at them. Like, confused, like, what do you mean? what organisation we're from, or, like, it could be a number of things.
Usually it doesn't surprise me at all, but this is not a very polite conversation. But the other night, this guy, it's the familiar hands on the body when they're dancing behind you, and I was like, bro, get off me. He was just like, oh, you're a disgusting Chinese bitch anyway, like fucking disgusting Chinese bitch. And I was like, oh, I usually hear disgusting bitch, but you don't have to. Now you just upped the game.
Well, it's one less question you have to answer.
That's true.
And so we come to the end of our time now.
I'm so sorry, I don't have to finish.
What a story to end on.
Does anyone have any brief final remarks?
Thanks for coming out.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Can I do one plug?
Please, plug.
I wanted to do a zine, and it's called Invasion, specifically about the housing crisis and xenophobic rhetoric.
Asian invasion?
Right. Invasion spelled with Asian.
Invasion. Oh, the Asian is in the invasion.
I didn't make it up. It was Pat Booth and Winston Peters in the 90s. They had a series of articles called Invasion. Anyway, but I ran out of time. So if anyone wants to contribute or like do something about it, it would be awesome. And we can make t-shirts as well. Great. Yeah.
Thank you all. That is us.